Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith.
Unless you actually back up the words with a consequence, settlement building is just going to proceed.
We continue our conversation with the distinguished physician and peace activist, Dr. Alice Rothschild. Dr. Rothschild is founder of Jewish Voice for Peace Boston and author of the 2007 book, Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, Stories of Jewish and Palestinian Trauma and Resilience. On her webpage, alicerothschild.com, she posts articles and op-ed pieces she has written over the years about the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. Dr. Rothschild hopes to educate Americans who are not receiving much media coverage about Palestinian life.
You know, when I talk to Palestinians, they say, we can't afford to be hopeless. And I always keep that in my heart.
She told us previously that her hope is to promote the human rights of both Israelis and Palestinians. She and her husband and two daughters also sing in a choir, a Basir Welt, which in English means a better world. We're listening to them in the background performing We Shall Not Be Moved. Dr. Rothschild is an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology and reproductive biology at Harvard Medical School, and she has devoted much of her medical career to working on behalf of poor, underserved communities. She has been a tireless advocate for women's rights and was medical director of the Women's Community Health Center in Cambridge, Mass. During the 70s. She then co-founded the nonprofit organization Urban Women and Child Health, Inc. in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, later joining the staff of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. She became a member of the staff of Harvard Community Health Plan, which is now called Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates. On her website, alicerothschild.com, Dr. Rothschild describes a visit she made to the West Bank in 2004 to assist at clinics in two Palestinian villages near Jenin. As of that year, she explained, the UN reported an estimated 50% of Palestinian women were delivering babies at home because they were unable to get through checkpoints and to a hospital. Many of the infants were dying or facing complications due to lack of care. We spoke with Dr. Rothschild July 27th at a time when the White House was ostensibly pushing Israeli leaders for a freeze on settlements as a way to help restart peace talks with Palestinians. In the time since, there have been reports of a compromise that would allow Israel to continue with plans for 2,500 more structures. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers in East Jerusalem and the West Bank have become more aggressive toward Palestinians. And on Sunday, August 2nd, Israeli security forces entered the homes of two Palestinian families as they slept, dragging them out of their homes and then moving all of their belongings out. Within hours, Israeli settlers moved into the homes. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton described the eviction as a provocation.
These actions are deeply regrettable. I have said before that the eviction of families and demolition of homes in East Jerusalem is not in keeping with Israeli obligations. And I urge the government of Israel and municipal officials to refrain from such provocative actions.
Since 1967, 35% of East Jerusalem has been appropriated for construction of 50,000 housing units for Jews, according to the Guardian magazine of London. At the same time, fewer than 600 housing units have been built for Palestinian residents with government support. Much has been said about hopes for peace. However, particularly during the Bush-Cheney years, settlement construction expanded, with some 500,000 Jewish settlers now living on land that once belonged to Palestinians. During our interview on the 27th of July, Dr. Alice Rothschild spoke about the significance of Israeli settlements when it comes to any peace talks or other kinds of negotiations.
I think that understanding the impact of the settlements is critical to understanding the conflict. Because if you can imagine that there is this territory called the West Bank, which is 22% of historic Palestine, which in the 80s, Arafat said, okay, just give us the 22% and we'll, agree to lay down our arms and recognize a two-state solution. And then you imagine, since 67, a steady growth of Jewish towns and cities, which are called settlements, into this territory, so that now there are some almost 500,000 Jews living in settlements and in Greater Jerusalem and ever-expanding neighborhoods in Jerusalem. This is a major land grab. And it also involves the most fertile soil and the water aquifers. And in the Middle East, water is gold. So what the settlements do is that they create facts on the ground. And these facts on the ground are totally in favor of Jewish settlers. So that, when you travel around the West, when I travel around the West Bank, you see all these cities that are built on hilltops. And then in the valleys, there are Palestinian towns that are basically starving, that don't have enough water, that don't have a good road, that don't have electricity. And what happens with the settlements is that there are sort of approved settlements, which are still illegal. And then there are unapproved settlements, which are also illegal. And the unapproved ones are the little caravans. And the settlements keep going further and further and further into the West Bank. And it's totally destroying Palestinian economy. Peace Now said that something like, I don't know whether it's 93% of settlements are built on private Palestinian land. There's some number that's just stunning. So this is a land grab, and this is attempting to create facts on the ground that when there's a final settlement will be in favor of Jews owning more territory without Palestinians in it. So I think the fact that Obama actually called attention to this was very important. I mean, as opposed to Bush, who said, oh, settlements are okay, and sort of gave his blessing. But it's not only settlement growth, it's the fact of settlements. Again, I go back to Ma'ale Adumim. They've only built on 10% of their land. They have 35,000 people. They have housing for 70,000 people. They're looking at having 1 million, and they have a huge amount of land that they can build on. So the settlements not only own where they're living, but they own a whole periphery of land around them. And then they come along with a whole military that has to defend them because they're in hostile territory. And then they have a road that only people with Israeli license plates, which in this case is Jews, can go on. So then you have roads that Palestinians can't cross. And then they use five times as much water as a Palestinian can use. And they get it cheaper. And their houses cost 50% less. And it goes on and on and on. So this is hugely important. And I don't think that most Americans really understand the significance of this.
Just tell listeners who the group Peace Now are.
Peace Now is one of the older peace movements within Israel. And I think they started in response to the Lebanon War in 1982. And they have been just plugging along, calling attention to the fact that there is a Palestinian narrative, trying to call attention to the implications of Israeli foreign policy for Palestinians. And they've particularly focused on the role of settlements. And the thing I find interesting is Peace Now can have a rally in Tel Aviv with 100,000 people, and we won't even see it in the paper. So it's, again, part of the reporting issue that we have, that people that are not going according to the cultural myths and the what's considered normative conversation, this kind of activity doesn't get reported. So Peace Now is actually an active peace group, but you don't hear about it very much.
The U.S. press is still discussing President Obama's call for a freeze on settlements. However, both the Israeli press, Haaretz, and the Palestinian Authority-leaning Al-Ahram are reporting that the negotiations about settlement building broke down, so it's not working.
This is not exactly surprising, because if you look at history since 1967, when the settlement building project really went into full swing, there has been no change in settlement growth, no matter who's been in charge in Israel, and no matter what they're saying, and no matter what peace process is ongoing. So the settlement project goes on no matter what. And I would argue that until there are some consequences to this, financial consequences, political consequences, the people in the Israeli government that facilitate settlement building have no reason to stop. So words are not enough. And I think this has been shown quite clearly over the last few decades, that unless you actually back up the words with a consequence, settlement building is just going to proceed. And the problem is that you know, 20% of the settlers are religiously motivated. Many of them are militant. You know, settlers carry huge guns. They shoot at Palestinians. They're really sort of the brown shirts of Israeli society. 80% of settlers are there because it's economically viable. You can get a cheap house. You can get a clean neighborhood. You can get a nice school. You know, you can get back into Israel in 2 seconds through tunnels and major highways. And those folks have said, if you give me a comparable deal in Israel, I'll move back in a second. So you got to back it up with some either financial problem or political problem or something. Otherwise, there's no motivation for the people who are pro-settlement building to change. And so Obama has to get, I mean, he has to really get tougher with Netanyahu, and I don't, you know, I hope he does, but I don't know if he will. I mean, no president has actually done that. The first Bush did something around funding that pushed Sharon to do the disengagement, but there's been very little financial pressure put on Israel to actually behave differently, and that's critical.
And, of course, not long after that, I think it was Ariel Sharon who called on all the world's Jews to come to Israel by 2020.
Right.
So it kind of is just going on regardless of what any U.S. leader might or might not do. In fact, that's how it seems.
Right. And the other interesting thing is that the Zionist dream was that all Jews would come to Israel. It would be obvious to them that that's the place to come. And the fact is that, first of all, 15% of Israelis actually live out of the country, that there are some years when more Israelis are leaving than coming, and that two-thirds of Jews actually live in the diaspora. And so what that means for me is that the definition of being Jewish is different than the definition of being an Israeli. And the diaspora Jews actually have a huge responsibility in this regard because we are not enmeshed in the conflict. We are watching it from afar. We are connected through emotion and history and culture and relatives and all that kind of stuff. But we have a right to speak, and we have a right to be critical, and we have a right to push our particular agendas as Jews, and that we're no less Jewish and no less valuable when compared to an Israeli Jew. And this is something that diaspora Jews have to kind of get over and wrap their brains around, because there's always a sort of like, oh my God, I should be living there kind of feeling. But the fact that people choose not to live there means that this is a problem. The Zionist dream is not the dream that they thought was going to happen, and that there are serious issues that make people think twice before making Aliyah. And I think that's an important statistic to remember.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. I'm Dori Smith, and we're speaking with Dr. Alice Rothschild, a Boston obstetrician and gynecologist working for peace between Palestinians and Jews. As Dr. Rothschild mentioned, one of the holdups is the lack of information in both Israel and America. In fact, the BBC's Mideast reporter Katya Adler has noted that maps in Israeli textbooks do not show Palestinians living in some parts of Palestine where they live today. She spoke with young Israeli boys living in a settlement, and they seemed unaware that Palestinians have not had much power when it comes to regaining land taken by Israel since the 1967 Day War.
Would they give up their homes for peace with the Palestinians?
I believe that we could give back land for peace, but I just don't believe it's possible.
Not today. Not with the leadership that the Palestinians have, that they have today. It just,
but they want their own country here. They say that this, your school, your houses are built on lands that should be theirs as part of their state.
I mean, when I see what a Hamas leader wants, he doesn't want me to come out of Efrat. He doesn't really care about Efrat. He has a problem with me living here. He has a problem with me as a Jew and as Israeli. And
even if we do give him these settlements and these parts, they'll ask for more after that. This won't be the end of it.
In Israel and Palestine, the sides have been drawn over 60 years of Israeli occupation. Long-held beliefs, prejudices, and fears are passed on to next generations. The facts about a given offer that could bring peace tend to fall victim to the battle for public opinion in Israel, Palestine, and America. The history of past negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians has long been overshadowed by rhetoric and sensational news reporting. And there has long been a policy of criticizing the messenger when the messenger is critical of Israel. U.S. scholar Norman Finkelstein has come under fire for years for his criticisms of Israel. However, he told an audience in stores this year that the Hamas government was prepared to negotiate with Israeli leaders just prior to Israel's attack on Gaza in January. If Hamas was becoming more moderate, Israel would have to stop settlements and give back land, Finkelstein argued. And this is what Israeli leaders are taking measures to avoid, he said.
If Hamas is talking moderately, if Hamas is acting responsibly, why not negotiate with it? And for Israel, that's the disaster, because negotiations could only have one possible terminus, ending, and that ending would have to be a full Israeli withdrawal from the West Bank, because those are the terms of international law.
Another factor threatening to derail peace between Israelis and Palestinians is the power and wealth that has been accumulating in the hands of the pro-settler, pro-expansion movement in Israel, propped up by politicians like Nationalist Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman.
We cannot accept this vision about absolutely, completely freezing of settlements.
Lieberman and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu insist that all of Jerusalem belongs to Israel. However, there are signs that the Netanyahu government, and particularly Lieberman, are vulnerable. Lieberman faces 31 years in prison if Israeli Attorney General Menachem Mazuzon indicts him on corruption charges. He is alleged to have committed bribery, fraud, breach of trust, money laundering, and obstruction of justice. The foreign minister has said that if indicted, he will step down. On Wednesday, August 5th, Lieberman stumbled politically again when he said publicly that he himself was more dangerous than Hamas or jihad combined, according to the Jerusalem Post. Even if indicted and even if he steps down, Avigdor Lieberman will have altered Israeli politics this year. He strengthened the Israeli settler movement, particularly some of the most extremist factions. During our conversation with Dr. Alice Rothschild, we discussed the religious right that has been working hard to get Jews all over the world to make Aliyah, a religious journey to Israel.
The dream of my life has been Aliyah, which, thank God, I fulfilled a couple of years ago. And the second mission is to build a strong base of support for Israel and the Jewish people in need around the world.
30 years ago, Rabbi Yekiel Eckstein, formerly with the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, began to capitalize on the desires of both Jews and Christians, hoping to make a spiritual connection with the Holy Land, Israel. The problem of how to share Jerusalem with others who also see it as their spiritual capital was overshadowed by discussions about a Jewish state in perpetual need of security. Rabbi Eckstein founded the group Wings of Eagles and created infomercials that were a combination of right-wing political propaganda and spiritual discussion. Eckstein also said he would work to bring Christians and Jews together, and he asked Christians to pay the airfare of Russian and Ethiopian Jews he said could die in another Holocaust today.
It's not just the money, as someone said to me before. It's the fact that we built a bridge to hundreds of millions of people around the world who stand with us at our time of need. We have raised $500 million.
The infomercials opened with videotape of a mountain of human bodies being buried in a mass grave outside of a German concentration camp. It was real footage from the latter part of World War II. The narrator chanted the words "end days" 3 times, and then the bodies were replaced with pages from the Bible, from Ezekiel. Rabbi Eckstein and supporters like Watergate felon Charles Colson, singer Pat Boone, and even Connecticut Senator Joseph Lieberman come in eventually with endorsements for the program. At least some of the people relocated by Eckstein and Wings of Eagles wound up living in the settlements. More recently, Eckstein has gone to work for the Israeli government, but the infomercials are still being aired in America. We asked Dr. Rothschild about Eckstein and others like him who have been rallying support for the Israeli right wing.
I would say that making an alliance with people whose main goal is to get you there so there can be an apocalypse and you can either die or convert is a really dubious kind of decision. And that Jews who do that have basically sold their soul. And a lot of the settlements are funded by the evangelical right. So you have to ask, you know, with friends like this, you know, what are you doing? It's another one of those serious problematic things in political history.
As an OBGYN specialist, someone who has the expertise to deliver children and take care of women. What about Palestinian women? What's it like to be pregnant in Gaza? How difficult is it? And what about kids there, too?
That's a very important way to look at the conflict, I think. You know, the average Palestinian woman has 6 children, which is a lot of pregnancies and a lot of deliveries. In the West Bank, there are huge complications getting from home to the clinic, to the hospital, and doing the kind of prenatal care and having adequate nutrition and the kind of things that we would think were appropriate for a pregnant woman. And in fact, there have been a steady stream of women being denied passage at checkpoints in labor, women bleeding to death in labor, children dying, you know, infants dying at checkpoints. And I was there 1 year when a set of premature twins died at a checkpoint. So for Palestinian women, the occupation is very personal. And the fear during pregnancy of having the ability to get to a facility is very, very great. And that's one of the ways that this comes home. In Gaza, there are not checkpoints between each village. It's just a completely devastated area where the healthcare system is on the verge of collapse in most places. There are issues of malnutrition. There are issues of just the presence of any healthcare. There's the issue of housing. It's a devastated war zone. And the water system has been contaminated by the sewage. I mean, I can't say more powerfully how destroyed Gaza has been by repeated incursions, economic blockade, internecine fighting, the last, you know, in December and January, the incredible bombardment. I mean, this is 5 miles by 26 miles in size. During that time, there was an estimated 3,500 women that gave birth outside of the hospital. And this was not planned home birth. So the risk to mothers and pregnant women and children is huge. If you go on the UN sites and the World Health Organization sites, there's a lot of excellent documentation about the health consequences of occupation, of war, of inability to get adequate water, nutrition, anemia, those kind of issues. So you see that very, very clearly. And the health indicators have been worsening over the years. There was a time when they were getting a little better, and now they're just plummeting. It's largely because this is a war zone and because of the blockade. I don't know if people understand that this is a blockade of just about everything. So people can't rebuild their homes. They can't get medication. Hospitals can't function because they can't repair equipment. I mean, it's devastating. And it's also invisible. And the fact that it's invisible is, again, a huge political and human rights issue.
A couple of BBC reporters have been sticking with this story about a 4-year-old Palestinian girl named Samir. They've interviewed her father about an event that just sounds horrific. A toddler's shot at point-blank range. She was the only survivor. And she now has a bullet in her spine. To what extent is it possible for Palestinian kids to get the kind of attention that kids in some other war zones get from international medical organizations?
There is some response from international groups and from groups from Arab countries and from the UN and World Health Organization. The big problem is that the Israeli government would not allow materiel into Gaza. And there's a blockade. It's, you know, it was in response to Hamas taking over. And it's a form of collective punishment that is devastating everybody. And these kids are not Hamas or Fatah or anything. They're kids, and they're trying to grow up. And the fact that that's not really possible right now is a human rights violation. And so the economic blockade, the siege of Gaza, is it doesn't matter how much medications are piling up on the border. If they can't get in, they can't get in. And so they're of no use. There are donations being made, and there are in the U.S. there are groups that are Palestinian Americans that raise money, but they can't get in. And that's a major problem. I don't know if you followed, there have been these boats leaving Cyprus coming with humanitarian aid to Gaza, both symbolically and, you know, actually. And the last boat, the Israeli Navy intercepted in international waters and took everybody on the boat to prison, including Cynthia McKinney, who's a former U.S. representative. This would be an international incident. This is piracy. In international waters, the Israeli Navy picks up a boat, and there was no coverage. So, again, there's this real double standard. I think it's not good for Palestinians, and it's not good for Israelis, and it's not good for the international community that we close our eyes to this.
What can Americans do to promote peace and help bring change?
Well, I think the first thing that Americans need to do is to get better educated and to recognize the limitations of our mainstream media. There are a lot of websites, Jewish Peace News, B'Tselem, Israel Committee Against House Demolitions, there's the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, there's Al Jazeera. I mean, there's a huge amount of information that is now available on the Internet that could give people a much more studied understanding of what's going on. And I also, nowadays, and this is one of the big changes, there are a lot of ways to go there and go beyond the traditional tour of Israel with the beautiful archaeology and forests and all that kind of stuff, and to go into the West Bank. And that's very doable these days. And then, since most people aren't going to go, but they get educated, then the question is, what do you do with that information? And there are a number of peace groups and political groups that are working on these issues. And so I would suggest that it's important to get politically active. And the reason is that as U.S. citizens, we're enabling this to happen. So we are actually responsible for this with our tax dollars. If we're Jews, then we're enabling it with both our charities and with our political cover and with our muzzling of dissent. And so for Jews, I think it's really important to work in our own communities, to be able to have an open conversation without everybody screaming at each other, which is generally what happens. I think for Christians, it's important to deal with the evangelical right and to really examine what it's doing and to look at all the boycott, sanction, divestment movements that have been debated in various Christian organizations but doesn't get very far. And for Muslim Americans, I think the moderate Muslim voice is rarely heard, so it's really important to speak out and be heard. And there are a lot of organizations in the U.S. that are crossing lines that are working together. You know, as an individual, writing letters to the editor, writing to your congressperson, really being tuned into, you know, what's the bias in the story and how can I make a comment that then gets heard in the papers or in the radio or whatever, is very important. So there's a lot of ways that we can have an impact.
Do you have any hope that the Obama administration and Special Envoy Mitchell can make a difference and maybe open the peace talks again?
I do have some hope, but I'm going to reserve my assessment until I see what happens. You know, there has to be a braver confrontation with Netanyahu and his friends to make this happen. And I think the big problem also is that the Israeli public, which is a largely secular public and largely apolitical, has moved to the right out of fear and out of misinformation and out of demonization of the other and all the forces that make people move to the right. So we have a more left-leaning president with a more right-leaning Israel. So one of the things that gives me hope is Israeli peace organizations and all the Palestinian civil society organizations, of which there are over 100, that are there ready to work with people, but they need support, they need money, they need publicity, they need our kind of support. So I have some hope. And, when I talk to Palestinians, they say, we can't afford to be hopeless. And I always keep that in my heart, that the people who are waiting in a checkpoint, who can't get to school, who have water once a week, or all the kind of things that make people nuts, they can't afford to give up because it's their lives. And if they can't afford to give up, then people who care about them can't afford to give up. So if you care about Israelis, if you care about Palestinians, if you care about U.S. policy, then you can't give up.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
We've been speaking with Dr. Alice Rothschild, founder of Jewish Voice for Peace, Boston. All royalties from her book, Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, Stories of Jewish and Palestinian Trauma and Resilience, are devoted to her peace group. The book was published by Pluto Press, and it's available at Barnes & Noble, or you can purchase it on her website, alicerothschild.com. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. You can listen to us on community radio stations like this one in Storrs, FM 91.7 WHUS Storrs, and you can find us online at talknationradio.org.